Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Monday, the 23rd of May, it's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 9 o'clock. And our guest this hour, Julian Zelizer, will introduce him momentarily. Hour number two of the show, a program I've been looking forward to, will speak with Jenny Scott, who is the author of A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. It highlights in great detail her work in Indonesia and is very, very well written. I think you'll enjoy that conversation with Jenny Scott, who worked for the New York Times for a number of years. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest the first hour today, and we have a lot to talk about. The president is in Europe. We will look at that. The president is defending his stance that talks over a Palestinian state should be focused on Israel's pre-1967 borders. We will talk about that. We'll look again at the Republican presidential possibilities. Indiana governor, who was somebody we were talking about quite a bit in the last few weeks, has decided he is not going to run for president. So who's in that race, and a number of other issues to look at as well. When we decide to go to war, who makes that decision? What's going on in Afghanistan? What about Pakistan? We haven't spoken with Julian since the killing of Osama bin Laden, so we will ask his opinion on that. He is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He has written many books examining U.S. political leaders, policies, and institutions since the New Deal. His most recent books are Jimmy Carter, Conservatives in Power, The Reagan Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, The Presidency of George W. Bush, A First Historical Assessment. He has published all over the place, Newsweek, Politico, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Daily Beast, Salon, The Huffington Post, The Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, and CNN.com. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Zelizer. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Zelizer, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's, I don't even know where to start today. Maybe we should start, the president is in Dublin. Why not? Let's start with the president's trip to Europe. What is he hope to accomplish on this journey?
Well, I mean, what people are saying is that a lot of the European trip might actually be about the Middle East. Mm. And following his comments about Israel, following bin Laden and all the changes that we're seeing, including his address on the Middle East, my guess is that's what he wants to talk to allies about, and that's what the plan that he wants to sell, whatever his vision is that's emerging.
Mm-hmm. And describe, is it sort of a lukewarm reception to his defending his stance that talks over the Palestinian state should be focused on the pre-67 borders?
Well, lukewarm or controversial within the United States, certainly I think the comments caught some people off guard and triggered the predictable outcry that you might imagine. And I think the president is leaving as things heated up here a bit over what he said. But if he wants to do this, if he wants to pull something off in this notoriously difficult region, he is going to need as much assistance as possible from allies. And I think many people are not overly enthusiastic about dealing with this right now. And so he's going to have to really win them over.
Mm-hmm. Why is this a notoriously difficult region, and why is it that every president has great hopes for making a permanent kind of peace, and those hopes are dashed?
Well, it's a messy region. I mean, part of it is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where you have limited territory and two groups are fighting over it, and tensions have just mounted terribly over the decades, and there's been a lot of death and killing, and both sides have real animosity and fears. And then the rest of the region, as we know, is filled with corrupt government, autocratic governments, layered over the property of oil, which is very important in this region. So it's this messy mix. It's a kind of messy stew. And to try to make something neat out of it is very difficult. And American interests there are mixed, and we have very different things that we are pursuing as a country. So it's hard to say we are for democracy if often we are allied with governments that are anything anything but. So presidents try to make something better out of it, but few have really been successful. And the difference with Obama is events there are really kind of taking over, regardless of what the United States wants. And so in some ways, Obama's playing catch-up rather than trying to dictate some kind of plan to improve the conditions.
Do you need a certain kind of leadership in Israel to make a peace, at least process, more possible?
Well, Israel, among the Palestinians, among the Arabs, I think the leadership there in the end is more important than the leadership here. When you had the kind of historic peace agreement when President Carter was in office, between Begin and who was the head of Israel, and Sadat, the head of Egypt, it was really their leadership, I think, that was instrumental. Both men from very different perspectives seized that moment to make an agreement that lasted for many decades, we often forget, and even with tension was quite successful. And so I don't know if there's a certain kind of leadership, but certainly you need leadership in among all these peoples who are willing to give away things in exchange for peace and who have a certain sense of security that they can make those trade-offs without some kind of disastrous outcome.
I haven't had a chance to speak with you since Osama bin Laden was killed. What do you make of that? What were your thoughts the day that happened?
Well, it was, you know, very dramatic moment. I think for anyone who lived through 9/11, experienced 9/11, and has followed the impact of 9/11, his death, really, I think, took everyone by surprise, but brought some kind of feeling, not necessarily of satisfaction or closure, but you know, the end of an enemy, and so I think many people shared that. At the same time, the problem is bigger than bin Laden, and I think that's very clear to the administration and to Congress. This was never a war against just a person. It's not a war against a particular government. It's a war against these networks of terrorism. And so while there's a certain amount of satisfaction from getting the leader, it's a leaderless operation, and I think that's part of what makes it difficult and extremely frustrating. There is no victory day when you're fighting this kind of war.
And what do you imagine is going on now with our relationship with Pakistan? Are we in high-level meetings with them, trying to figure out a way to root out terrorists in that country, to get more support from them? We haven't heard much about it lately.
We haven't. I mean, Pakistan has always been, you know, since 9/11, there have been constant concerns and discussions, certainly in Washington, about this very shaky ally that we were dealing with. They were an ally that was never fully trusted. There was always suspicions about their alliances with al-Qaeda and how we could give money to a notoriously corrupt government and one with its own interests. So these discussions have been going on. Many have always said Pakistan's the most dangerous country in terms of U.S. foreign policy. And I think right now, I'm sure, there are behind-the-scenes negotiations and discussions to understand what happened, to understand what exactly the relationship was with bin Laden, and what other kinds of intelligence is out there. But it's difficult. I mean, Pakistan has not been a very friendly ally, and it's unclear what their aspirations are in the next, you know, 5-10 years. So it's like the Cold War in some ways. We often have these allies who can easily turn into our enemies, and that's a very difficult foreign policy trick.
Would you agree that it is the most dangerous country?
Sure. It's certainly one of them, and it's an area where you have this combination of extremism, nuclear weapons, and intense corruption. And when you have that kind of mix, it's hard to predict what the players are up to and who exactly you are dealing with at a given moment. But certainly it was shocking, and there can be all kinds of explanations, but to have bin Laden in what appeared to be a relatively easily identifiable location in the country, certainly has to raise suspicions for many people, and it has in Congress when they're starting to ask questions about what they're doing over there.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch to U.S. politics for a moment. In the Republican presidential field, Mitch Daniels is not going to run, evidently, for president. He was somebody whose name was much in the news a couple weeks ago. Newt Gingrich is having some problems gathering support for his candidacy. Who looks best for the Republicans?
I mean, look, you know, Mitt Romney is a little bit like, you know, the Rodney Dangerfield of the Republican Party. He gets no respect, and he's running all the time. And I think, you know, he still remains a front runner just because there aren't many others. And he can raise money, he can appear on television, and he has had this gubernatorial experience in Massachusetts. So he comes out of this feeling better. Tim Pawlenty comes out of this feeling better because, you know, he is seen as the Main Street Republican, the Republican who can tap into some of this Tea Party anger, yet doesn't appear at least to be an extremist and might be able to capture the hearts and minds of Midwestern voters. So those two are the big ones. John Huntsman remains someone who's talked about with his foreign policy credentials, his appeal to bipartisanship because he served for Obama. But many people are wondering whether he really has what it takes for a presidential run. So the three you hear about are the three who are the front runners, and most of them are probably happy Daniels stepped down. Many Republicans in the establishment really liked Mitch Daniels, and they thought he was the one person who could make a serious run at President Obama. Others might emerge, you know, from New Jersey's Governor Chris Christie to some others, but it's unclear, you know, they'd be able to put together a campaign in a few months that could challenge someone who will be a very powerful incumbent and someone who can raise a lot of money quickly.
Yeah. Well, let's look at this, what strikes me to be a division in the Republican Party. Mitt Romney, Tim Pawlenty considered much more moderate than someone like Daniels or Christie. Is the Republican Party really struggling with this, and can they come up with a consensus candidate who may be more amenable to voters who are in the middle?
Well, they're going to have to. You know, if they want to run a campaign that just plays to the extreme elements of the party, they're going to lose. That won't win a general election. I think there was some appeal to Daniels and Christie in that they can appeal to the hardcore budget-cutting elements of the party who want, you know, tax cuts and budget cuts, yet neither of them are social conservatives who really are concerned with those kinds of issues. Pawlenty, I think, is more of a mystery still. He still comes out of that, you know, fiscally conservative budget-cutting appeal, at least. That's what his rhetoric is, and someone who, you know, average America can appeal to, and he can make the case this is not the Republican Party of Wall Street. So, you know, he still has some potential, if he can survive the national spotlight. You know, that's always harder for Mitt Romney, given his background. He can appeal to those who aren't socially conservative, but he has trouble making the appeal to working and middle-class Americans who want a Republican Party that isn't beholden to big business and to Wall Street, because that's where Romney comes from.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest for All Things Political is Professor Julian Zelizer. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, has written many books on the U.S. presidents. He has written Jimmy Carter, also Conservatives in Power, The Reagan Years, co-author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, The Presidency of George W. Bush, A First Historical Assessment, and he is a very well-known commentator in the national and international television, radio, and print mediums. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Coming up, hour number two of our show, Janie Scott will be with us. She has the new and highly acclaimed book, A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. We go to your phone calls now. Feel free to join the conversation as we talk about the president's trip to Europe, his comments on Palestinian state who's in the presidential field right now. We have yet to talk about taxes and debt ceiling and all of that. We'll get into it as the hour progresses. But we do have phone calls, lines open, so feel free to give us a ring. We start our calls with Jim from Milwaukee. Hello, Jim.
Hi. Looking forward to 2012, it seems to me that the Democratic strategy should be to appeal to their base and also the independents, and to treat the Republican base as just basically a joke. And with that in mind, I'd like to suggest a scenario where Michelle Bachmann appears on Fox News and accuses Obama of being associated with a subversive group, meeting a subversive group on the back porch of the White House. And the name of the group would be the BDSOA, which stands for Black Dice Shooters of America. And she would predict that the dice shooters would roll out a program to deal with the debt, but that it would only have a 1 in 6 chance of success. Now, of course, I made all of this up, but as far as I can see, made-up stuff is plenty good enough for Fox News.
Well, I mean, that is the sentiment of many Democrats, but I think more importantly, it points to what I do think Democrats expect the president's reelection strategy to be, and what I think many Republicans are worried about, and that is a campaign that tries to paint whoever is the candidate as an extremist, as far off center, and is not reflecting where most of the country is. We're seeing this tested right now in a special election in New York to replace the seat of a representative who was caught up in a scandal, Christopher Lee. And a Democrat has been making a run at a very, very conservative district by focusing on Paul Ryan's plan to cut Medicare and arguing that the Republicans are really calling for draconian cuts that even conservatives don't agree with. And I think if this works, this is what the Democrats are going to do. They're going to say Republicans don't reflect most of America. They are dealing not with facts but fiction. And so it's going to be incumbent on the GOP to pick a candidate who is able to withstand and respond to that. And that's part of what their primary is going to be about, which candidate can do that best.
Thank you, Jim, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Are you paying special attention to Wisconsin, Professor Zelizer? Because it seems to me as though the recall elections, which will take place on July 12 in this state, will also be indicative of something.
Well, I must say, after the initial Scott Walker controversies, I've been focused more on New York than Wisconsin. But I think it's a similar kind of problem playing out, whether it's the recalls, whether it's the special election. And, you know, Walker raised it in Wisconsin first, frankly, even before Paul Ryan did, on how far voters are willing to tolerate the implementation of what many Republicans have been talking about for a few years. And there's been more blowback and pushback than I think many in the GOP had expected.
And so what does that mean for the GOP? I'm trying to figure out what their long-range strategy is for dealing with this.
Well, I mean, they have two problems. One is on policy. They're going to have to offer a response to the increasingly vocal Democratic criticism that the Republicans are calling for too much. They're calling for cuts that are not healthy for the nation, that will take away benefits many Americans focus on. The more the Republicans talk about the specifics, the more trouble they've had. And they're going to need an answer. They're going to say, they need to say, you know, why should we cut Medicare and Medicaid this much if many voters want those benefits to remain in place? So they have a problem of policy. And then nationally, they have a problem of personality. They don't have any clear, strong candidates to articulate these issues. Some say Paul Ryan might be the person, although he has caused a lot of problems for the GOP since he announced his plan. I don't know how the Republicans resolve this, but they have to. They can't just let these charges sit. They can't not respond to this criticism that's been raised about what they're doing nationally with the budget or in states with unions and collective bargaining.
Mm-hmm. So we'll all come to a loggerhead sometime this year.
It will come to a loggerhead, and my guess is what Republicans want to do is shift the debate back to abstract issues, meaning, you know, when Republicans talk about why government is bad, when they talk about the need to cut the deficit without saying how to do it, they often have done quite well in the past year. They've put Democrats in a defensive position. When Democrats shift to the specifics, to, you know, we can't get rid of policy A, we can't get rid of the unionization rights of these workers, that's when Republicans have trouble. So I think you're going to see this back and forth where Republicans talk philosophically and Democrats talk more like policy wonks, because, you know, which way the debate is framed, I think, will matter a lot in terms of how voters are thinking next year.
800-486-8655, our number. Carol in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Carol.
Hi. First of all, let me identify myself. I am not a Mormon. But why is it every time Mitt Romney's name is brought up, they say, I heard someone locally say, well, it's his health plan, and he's a Mormon. Well, what does that have to do with it?
That's a fair question, and it's hard to avoid it now, you know, since he ran the first time. It's always become this issue of, will a Mormon be accepted in the conservative, in the Republican primaries, where there are many evangelical conservatives who, according to the conventional wisdom, wouldn't vote for a Mormon. That's how the issue comes in. Is it a legitimate issue? Of course not. And, you know, when you hear the religion of one candidate being mentioned and the others are not, that should raise all the red flags about why we always don't want this to be injected into our political debate. So I think she's right, but I don't think that will go away, certainly until he proves it's not an issue. You know, that's ultimately how these issues go away. When you can win that doesn't seem decisive with voters, then people will move on. But there is no reason to think that's a legitimate or serious question in terms of evaluating Romney. They should be talking about his record as governor, about his policies, about what his vision is for the country.
And how is he handling the health care issue? Massachusetts, of course, the national model we have now, based in large measure on Massachusetts. Is he having to defend that, or is it working so well that he can tout it and say this was an accomplishment?
He has been a bit defensive at first. Many said, how can a Republican win who was responsible for the plan that's essentially a model for Obama's plan? How will he ever attack Obama for his signature issue if he himself passed the same thing? He gave a speech trying to say this is something he is proud of. Romney made this speech, and at the same time, there are differences between what he did and what Obama did. You know, I don't think you can run away from your record. I think in the end he has to embrace that that was something he helped to create. And I think he makes a mistake if he doesn't run as a Republican who can deal with issues like health care. He can still distinguish himself from the president. That's not hard to do. But if he goes too far and distances himself from really the main thing he did in Massachusetts, he's going to come up with the same problem he did in the last race. People will say he's not credible, he speaks out of both sides of his mouth, and he's not trustworthy. So I think he needs to sell what he did at the same time he still criticizes the president. And there's new issues. It's not all about Obama's health care plan anymore. It's now about the economy, deficits, and spending cuts. Those kinds of issues he can continue to speak on.
Wayne and Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Wayne.
I guess I'd like to say first, unlike Jim from Milwaukee, I'm not going to demonize anybody. I think it's going to be a very interesting race in 2012. But to my point, I think we need to give Paul Ryan a vote of thanks for at least bringing something to the table. It's a starting point. And Mr. Ryan on Sunday said, no, this isn't the finished product. But at least the Republicans brought something to the table. All the Democrats are doing is hurling epithets and ad hominem attacks against Paul Ryan and other Republicans. So I'm saying let's, you know, let them both get together and maybe duke it out and come up with a plan. But the Democrats have to at least come up with something and not demagogue their opponents as they continually do. I'm opposed to that. What is your thoughts, guest? Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Wayne.
Well, I mean, I think to be fair, both sides do a lot of demagoguing. This is not something that one party does and the other doesn't. The Republicans have done plenty of demagoguing about President Obama in the past few years, and so it's hard to say this starts with Ryan somehow. I mean, President Obama has been accused of being a socialist, and I think he's far from that. Is there a need for serious discussion? Yes, but I think the response would be Republicans have to talk about things like tax increases if they really want to talk about deficit reduction as opposed to spending cuts. Should Ryan get credit for bringing the issue to the table? Sure, you could say that, but I think there are people in both parties, including members of the administration, who are concerned about everything from the economy to the fiscal strength of the country. And so I hope demagoguing goes away. It probably won't. The reality is these issues have to be solved in a partisan, polarized atmosphere, because that's what we have in Washington. But a true discussion will have to include both spending cuts and tax increases, and it will have to include a discussion of, is this really the time to cut the deficit, as the economy is just starting to gain a little strength but remains very weak. If you take those two issues off the table, you're not having a serious discussion.
You wrote a piece for CNN.com early in May about Senator Tom Coburn, a staunch conservative who triggered a heated debate among conservatives when he acknowledged that tax increases might be necessary if Congress really wants to reduce the deficit. And then you go on to talk about the fact that Ronald Reagan raised taxes.
Yeah, I mean, Reagan started his presidency with a historic tax cut in 1981, which reduced rates to the lowest level since World War II. But then in 1982, he accepted increases in taxes because many members of his own party in the Senate were saying the deficits are simply too large and we'll never cut them if we don't raise more money. Reagan in 83 increased Social Security taxes, realizing the program needed to be fixed in the short term, and they passed a bipartisan reform that included that. And so the point was there was a moment when Republicans, even the staunchest tax cutters, understood that, you know, you need to raise money, not just cut spending, if you want to deal with deficits and debt. I think there is a bit of unreality, so to speak, right now. Those have been taken off the table. The tax part of the discussion is simply not there in the GOP. And when Tom Coburn, a staunch Republican, suggested that he would be open to those kinds of discussions, he came under immense attack. And I think the tradition of the Republican Party is not just cutting taxes. And there needs to be a realization of that right now.
Randy in Green Bay. Hi, Randy.
Hi, good morning. I comment on your last statement. I think significantly some of the things have to be cut in the economy. I mean, it's such a disarray in most of the country. My comment was basically where I called in for was for the waivers for the Obamacare. There's 1,300 waivers that went basically to Nevada, the whole state of Nevada, and Nancy Pelosi's district. And if my comment is, if this Obamacare is supposed to be so good for the nation and for the people, why are these waivers extended to all these people and to the constituents of the Democratic Party?
What waivers are you talking about, Randy?
Healthcare waivers. For Obamacare?
Professor Zelizer?
Yes. Look, this was reported in the news a little while ago, where there have been waivers for certain businesses from the federal law, including businesses in Pelosi's district and in Reid's district. I don't know, to be honest, if this is the most of any part of the country. There was criticism about the waivers from Democrats when this started, that, you know, you'd come under this kind of attack down the line, that why do certain people opt out of it if it's so good? The reality is the health care plan was, A, incredibly complex, And I think the administration tried to set up what Republicans often call for, a dynamic system that can be adjusted, it could be tailored, and it could be put together over time, and sometimes waivers are necessary. It's also political. Passing health care was difficult, and part of this is a way to get this thing up and running and dampen some of the criticism. Pelosi is not in favor of the waivers. Neither is Harry Reid. It's the businesses in their districts that are really fighting for this. But there is a fairness to what the caller said, that there is a discrepancy or a contradiction between a strong federal program and a program that allows for people to opt out of it. But that's the reality of how you build a program, and slowly this one is taking shape.
Yeah, it doesn't seem right to be able to opt out of it.
Well, no, and especially, I mean, I always thought, you know, the kind of striking contradiction is you're kind of mandating the fact that people need to purchase health care, which is central to the program in terms of lowering the cost of insurance by basically getting healthy people to buy insurance, and then you have this kind of waiver. But it's not defining the program. I think the number of waivers is often exaggerated relative to the number of businesses and people who will be complying. And so sometimes you take whatever it was, 200 waivers, and say everyone's leaving this program. And that's not what's happening right now.
Right.
In general, the program is going forward. But you have to deal then with the criticism this caller raised.
Right, which is
do stuff like this.
It's legitimate criticism.
Yeah.
Randy, thanks very much for your call. We have lines open. If you'd like to join us for All Things Political this morning with Professor Julian Zelizer, one of our favorite All Things Political guests, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of so many books on various U.S. presidents, on conservatives in power, on The Arsenal of Democracy, very well known for that book, The Politics of National Security, From World War II to the War on Terrorism. And he writes, he's a prolific writer and commentator on all things political all over the place. Lines are open, and we have an email, which you can also use this morning. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jannie Scott joining us following the news from National Public Radio. Her book is A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. We go to phone calls again. John in Fond du Lac, hi.
Yes, good morning. I was just calling earlier. Your guest touched on the issue of the unreality of the situation that we find ourselves in. And I was wondering if you could comment specifically about the recent poll that was just announced this morning showing that the American public believes it's possible to solve our budget problem without touching either Social Security or Medicare. And how does that reflect upon our political leadership that, like the Republicans, who tell us that we can, you know, solve it with budget cuts and possibly even more tax cuts? How do we, I guess, convince the American public of the seriousness of the situation?
Oh, I think that's an equally fair point. Most spending in the U.S. budget is not discretionary spending, meaning it's not money that every year Congress decides we should spend for X or Y. Most of it goes to pre-committed programs, meaning programs we've already said we're going to spend on, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, the military, paying off the debt. That's where most of the budget is. So if we want to deal with the budget side of fiscal policy, those programs have to be on the table. And it is a similar kind of problem. Often we don't want to talk about those programs. And, you know, it often raises more opposition than support, people find, when you're talking about making those cuts. But I think if we hit a point where we want to have a true discussion over the next 10, 15 years of where the budget is. That will have to be on the table, like tax increases. And we'll also have to have, though, a serious discussion about what Social Security cuts would mean. It's not simply, well, let's cut the budget and cut this program, because there'd be a huge impact of those cuts on elderly Americans, on the families that would have to support elderly Americans. It's hard to find the space that you need in Washington to have that kind of discussion, because both parties go back to their trenches and both parties are willing to use any comment against the other. But at some point, it is the kind of thing we'll have to have. And we've had those discussions before. Social Security's actually been reformed many times in the past, and we shouldn't think that it's impossible that that would happen again.
Thank you, John, for your call. Mike in Madison, hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask the professor, you know, the comment that you made about that it takes a while for, you know, a program to develop, you know, in relation to the Health Care Reform Act. I'm assuming there's been some postdoc somewhere who's done some sort of, you know, an analysis of, like, you know, we passed AFDC at a certain point, we passed Social Security in 34 or something like that. About how long does it take for a program to fully bloom bureaucratically so that it actually is functioning the way it was sort of semi-intended to?
Well, that's a very good question. Medicare, it was amazingly quick. It's passed in the summer of 1965. Lyndon Johnson is very clear that within a year he wants the program up and running, because he's nervous that opponents will be attacking it. He wants Americans to see this thing can work. And equally important, he wants doctors to realize it's in their interest. It's not something they really need to be against. And so within 1 year, it was this amazing year of 1966, where the Social Security Administration that ran Medicare got the thing up and running. And it was really difficult because it also forced Southern hospitals to desegregate so that they could receive federal monies. So that's an example of a quick implementation. Social Security, on the other hand, passed in 1935. Initially, it was a very small program. Most people didn't receive benefits. Many occupations weren't even covered. In the first few years, many people thought Social Security would not last, frankly. In the 1940s, during World War II, the program is a mess. The taxes are frozen by Congress in 1943 and 44. And one member of the administration in 1949 of the Truman administration says it's nip and tuck whether Social Security is going to survive. So it took over 15 years, really about 20, until Social Security started to become what it is today. It's not until the early 70s that Social Security is this huge program that covers most of the elderly population and which is seen as politically invincible. Passed in 35, totally triumphant in 72. That's a long wait time. So there's really a range of different programs in terms of how long they will take. But often it takes at least several years to really get it working.
And how virulent was the opposition to both of those programs, starting with Medicare?
Medicare was extremely strong.
Was
the same
it?
Kind of arguments we saw with Obama. The American Medical Association had a campaign, a very tough campaign, calling this socialized medicine. Doctors were handing out pamphlets in their offices to patients when this was being debated in Congress, warning about how this will destroy the relationship between patients and their doctors. Some doctors are saying they're going to boycott the program after it passes. The insurance industry is dead set against this because essentially it's going to cut them out in their minds. And gradually that does fade. And what happens is, as Medicare is working, more people interest see it's in their benefit and it's not something they need to worry about. So doctors are getting money from Medicare patients. Hospitals do quite well from the influx of patients and federal monies. And gradually all these interests turn and they're supporting the program and making it very difficult to change. And so you had just as fierce an opposition. And my guess is you might have the same dynamic with this program. As more Americans see what the benefits are, as more in the medical industry see, hey, this is going to bring in more patients, you might see the program strengthen. And the polls have shown that even though many Americans don't support still Obama's health care abstractly, when you talk about specific provisions, there's a lot of support for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how a debate like this can turn.
Thanks, Mike. Mary in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
This is kind of going back to something that's both a comment and a question to your guest. I guess that, you know, we give Paul Ryan's getting a lot of kudos for being courageous. We don't seem to give the same acclaim to Obama for attempting to reform health care. It's not been called courageous. It's been called socialistic and all kinds of other things, just a comment. And tell me if I'm wrong about this, but it's my understanding that there are some provisions in the Affordable Health Care Reform Plan that address Medicare, in particular the Advantage Care programs. And I'll take my answer off the
air. Thank you, Mary, for your call.
I mean, on the first part, there were some who said it was courageous. Again, you get the division between his supporters and his opponents. And for a new president to invest his political capital in his first, 2 years in what's always been one of the most contentious policy debates in this country, at least since the 1940s, certainly was courageous and risky. Trying to deal with one of our biggest problems, escalating health care, many did feel was courageous, even as it really damaged the Democratic Party. If he hadn't dealt with this and dealt with the economy, something, Democrats would still control the House, and Obama's approval ratings would be much higher. So I think that's just who you're listening to. But I do think it's a fair question to ask, and whether the media treated it the same way. The point of this health care plan, in part, was to contain the cost of Medicare. This was a cost-saving program as much as one to give Americans insurance, meaning there was a realization in the White House that health care costs are too high, Medicare costs are too high, and that they're unsustainable. And so there are parts of this program that if they went into effect, if this all works out, they will lower the cost of Medicare. And if you remember, during the legislative debates, Republicans turned this and said that Obama's trying to cut Medicare to pass his health care reform, just in terms of the complexity or interesting nature that political debate takes on in this day and age. But certainly all the health care programs are related, and that's what makes this a hard area of policy. You can't fix one part without fixing the other. So you can't lower Medicare costs until you start to fix a lot of the problems that we have in our health care system. And once you don't do one, you won't do the other.
Jim in Port Edwards. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. My only comment is that the waivers that are granted don't exempt those organizations from the health care plan. They just delay the application of it. My son is an economics professor at Georgia State University and has studied this plan and reported to the state, and that's his comment on it, that does not exempt those corporations or people or groups from the plan. I'd like to hear the professor's comment on that.
Well, some of these are to delay the implementation. That is true. You know, one of the criticisms, though, in response to that, is that if you don't require a business to do this, if they're exempted, quote-unquote, temporarily, they'll essentially be able to opt out for a long period of time. It's hard to put them back in once they've gotten out. That's one of the criticisms that is raised. I believe there were some waivers that actually were not permanent, but more permanent than that. So that's the response to what those are. And again, I think it still raises a political difficulty that you're allowing some people not to do this right now when you're requiring others to do it. And the administration does need a response to that.
Thank you, Jim, very much for your call. Wayne on the road. Hi, Wayne.
Hello there.
Hi.
It's Dwayne.
Oh, it's Dwayne.
Hey, I got a question here. They keep raising taxes the way they are. Why don't they pay down the deficit? They just keep spending. Spend, 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 spend. They always find something to spend it on, but nobody ever gets any paid. And also, Social Security would not be in the fix it's in if the Democrats wouldn't have had thrown it into the general fund years ago under President Lyndon Baines Johnson. If they would have kept their hands off of it, it would be a very, very sellable solution, and it would still be there. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Dwayne.
Well, the first, we have to remember this. We had a surplus at the end of President Clinton's presidency, and that surplus evaporated in large part because of tax cuts. So not tax increases, but tax cuts. Some of the tax cuts were extended, most of them, by President Obama in the lame duck Congress. Many people criticized him, saying, don't extend these tax cuts for the wealthy because you won't get out of the deficit problem that you have. So, in fact, we have had tax cuts, and we have to keep that very big policy decision of President Bush, whether you agree or disagree with it, on the table and not pretend that's not a big part of what we're dealing with right now. That's how we lost a lot of the surplus. And on the second, you know, Social Security isn't gone. It's not there. Some would say it's one of the more fiscally responsible programs, meaning in general we still collect how much we pay out. The problem is, over the long term, you know, how high do you have to raise the taxes to sustain this as the baby boomers retire? But, you know, most programs, what we have done outside of Social Security is say we want to do Project X, you raise the money, and hopefully you pay for it over time. Social Security is one of the few programs where we think about how much is it going to cost in 75 years, because it's basically a pay-as-you-go program. We take in every month how much we're going to pay out. And there's some say Social Security is in decent shape still, and some minor adjustments in benefits and taxes can make the program solvent for a long time. It's just a question of, do we want to spend it on the elderly? And that's a different kind of debate. And if that's the debate, let's have an honest one, rather than talking about the program having disappeared, which it didn't, to talk about, is this where we want to commit our resources?
Ron in Milwaukee, hi.
Yes, hi. I just keep wondering why the news people and the teacher people don't question and challenge what's wrong with socialism. And we're talking about real socialism, which is how the America and how the Christian nation, even Jewish, I mean, all religions take care of the weak, the out of work, the downtrodden.
Okay, your phone is awful, Ron, but we get the picture here. Why do people get so crazy about the word socialism? Professor Zelizer.
Well, I mean, look, part of it is you know, historically, it's just the history of the term, what it meant when it was connected to the Soviet Union and during the Cold War, both how, you know, some demagogues in the United States used the issue to really eviscerate the left wing of the Democratic Party, part of it more broadly, legitimate, very serious fears about state-controlled economies that, you know, also did many bad things and didn't lead to many good economic outcomes. It has to do with the end of the Cold War, which for many people made the argument of the United States the correct one, that kind of system didn't work. And part of it is about contemporary demagoguery, where we're both on the left and the right, you know, we don't want debates about ideas. And if someone has an argument like this, that there's maybe parts of socialism or any other kind of political idea that we should at least talk about, you know, instantly the attacks begin. But socialism certainly is not front and center, other than being a form of rhetoric that's very effective still. Surprisingly,
it sure is.
The Cold War is gone at attacking Democrats.
It sure is effective. Ellen from Milwaukee.
Hi. Oh, hello.
Thanks. Hi, Ellen.
For taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just, we were speaking about Social Security a little bit ago, and I was under the impression, and I heard this from many sources, mostly on NPR, that the Social Security Trust Fund has been borrowed by the government, that the government owes the Social Security Trust Fund $2.6 trillion, and that's part of that $14 trillion of the debt that we have.
Professor Zelizer.
The Social Security, again, you know, the way in which the program has always been paid is we take in Social Security taxes as much as we have to pay out. There has been a surplus that's been collected at different points, invested in government securities rather than in private markets. If you remember, President Bush wanted to shift that to private markets. And that's how the program has worked. But in general, the program right now is, I don't think, the kind of disastrous fiscal mess that many people painted out to be. And then the arguments about the trust funds being raided and stolen by the government, I think, is a bit of rhetoric. It's just this excess is invested in government surpluses. But the heart of the program, the heart of this program, has always been and remains a pay-as-you-go system. We're taking in as much as we take out. Whether we want to do that's a different question.
Professor Zelizer, always a great pleasure to have you on the air with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books, including Jimmy Carter, Conservatives in Power, The Reagan Years, 81 to 89, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, and the Presidency of George W. Bush. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee. We'll continue.